let me start that again. Holy crap. Can I just say ECMO?
Welcome to the Journal of Special Operations Medicine. I'm your co-host, Alex Merkel.
And I'm Josh Randles. And this is where evidence-based medicine meets unconventional warfare.
The views and opinions you are about to hear are the speaker's own, and nothing contained herein is to be considered the official opinion of the Journal of Special Operations Medicine or the U.S. government, including the Defense Health Agency, Department of Defense, Department of the Army, Navy, or Air Force.
Hey, podcast listeners. Josh from the JSON Podcast. We first want to thank you for tuning in to this spring 2024 edition of the JSON Podcast and make some acknowledgments. Both Alex and I were pretty busy this quarter, and so there will be some notable differences to this podcast edition. The first you'll notice is that we do not have our author interviews. We'll be working hard to make sure that we have summer 2024's author interviews secured and ready to go for that edition. So we'd like to apologize and let you know that we are working diligently to make sure that the summer 2024 edition is up to our usual standards. So thanks for coming along. Thanks for listening. And here is the JSON Podcast for spring 2024.
Josh, welcome back to the grid, my friend. It sounds like you have been off doing interesting things with interesting people in the woods. Was that fun? And do you have any good takeaways?
calling that fun, it was an experience. I don't know if it was fun. I mean,
is it type two fun?
which type error are we talking about? It, I don't know, man. Like, to be honest, I was asked that, which is it a type one error or type two error during my dissertation defense, and I had forgotten at that moment, and I immediately responded with the typical, like, E5 in front of a board. I just gave an answer and was very confident about it. And he said, "Are you sure?" And I said, "Absolutely." And afterwards, I went and asked that particular questioner, "Did I get it right?" He's like, "No, you completely screwed that up."
But you did it con gusto.
Just full sent it, man. No, I it's interesting. You go to these big rotations that are very maneuver heavy, and I'm often reminded about how much the ground force commander, and it only gets worse the further up they go from, like, company to battalion to brigade, how much they have to be concerned about as a commander: personnel, intelligence, operations, supply, comms, you know, current ops, future ops, like, what they're doing is affecting the battle space and all those sorts of things. And often we in medical feel like we're being left alone to our own devices, especially you talk about these big rotations. And it's not that they're not trying to train. They're doing the best they can to train with the very unique experience that we have as medical providers in the scenario. But what you got to think about is how much is actually going on, and how medical is just this very small subset of all of the concerns the commander has. And often, as opposed to operations, which are forward-leaning things that the unit is doing to try to affect a battle space, medicine is actually contingency, which is hard to sometimes swallow, is that while we need to be trained and be ready to go, we're actually contingency in case something goes wrong. And so, especially for all these new, for all the new providers, all the new medics, anybody out there who hasn't been in operations for a while, it's not that they're ignoring us, it's that they got so much else to go on. And so what we really have to do is medical personnel, wherever we are, at whatever level of command, and the experienced ones, I think, will tell you this, is that we just need to be there to give our plan as it fits within the commander's plan, so that if something goes wrong, we have a plan to get them out. And if you do that, if you just look at what the commander's got going on and what they're planning on doing, and you say, okay, well, you know, given that and what I can offer, this is what I can offer you within that, and this is how we'd work within what you're trying to do, you know, you'll do a lot. So it's sort of my reflection on my month of being at a big rotation, reminding myself that I'm a contingency in a very small part of a very big plan.
Yeah, it seems like that's what a lot of even the senior physicians, but especially junior physicians and healthcare professionals pivoting from the hospital institutional setting where they are the final decision maker to trying to appreciate that they are a small part. The commander's the decision maker. They will ask your opinion when the time is relevant. They will consider your opinion and they will make their decision. Whether it agrees or disagrees with your opinion is a very hard pivot for a lot of our colleagues to appreciate. But I'm so glad that you got a gentle or not so gentle reminder.
It's fine. I've been gently and ungently reminded many times of my place, and I don't mind anymore. I like my place. It's a nice place. I built it up. It's got a couch. It's fine.
Next up, we've got, as of this week, Dr. Devin DeFeo, who's graduating USHUS and heading on to emergency medicine residency. Very well-deserved congratulations, my friend. What do you have for us today?
With me today, I have United States Air Force Combat Rescue Officer Cameron Strawn. Cameron, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great, Devin. Thank you for having me.
Dude, it's my pleasure. Really excited about hearing what you have for us today. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself first, though?
Yeah, of course. So Cameron Strawn, grew up in San Diego, California. I attended University of Arizona and graduated in 2015. Right around that time, I joined the Air Force, commissioned as a second lieutenant, and then soon after went through the pararescue pipeline to become a combat rescue officer. That pipeline wrapped up for me in 2017. Soon thereafter, I got my team commander rating, deployed to Horn of Africa, which this paper actually addresses quite a bit, deployed the next year to Afghanistan, and then did two stateside deployment rotations as a team commander for a rescue force supporting the Human Space Flight Program for NASA.
Wow, that sounds pretty cool. Thanks a lot for giving us the time today. Can you tell us a little bit about the paper, about, I understand it's military working dogs?
So I'll be reviewing a paper that functions as a SOP or standard operating procedure. It's meant for deployed providers, dog handlers, and veterinary specialists. The title of the paper is Deployment and Implementation of Standard Operating Procedure for Military Working Dog Blood Collection, Storage, and Transport by Captain Elizabeth Evernham, who's a veterinarian in the U.S. Army, Captain Benjamin T. Fidelis, U.S. Air Force Captain, and Major Kayla Knuff from the U.S. Air Force.
So what's the main point of this paper? If you could give us, like, in a nutshell, what is this trying to achieve?
Yeah, so a little bit of background on the paper. So I deployed to Horn of Africa in 2018. Horn of Africa is an interesting theater. Basically, the U.S. forces there are advising, training, and assisting local forces in order to defend against a terrorist group called Al-Shabaab. So the way that the geography of that area looks, it's a very large theater, and there is really only one large logistical hub. And then from there, out into Somalia and Kenya primarily, you've got a handful of really small FOBs that are geographically separated from any large logistical support. And on those FOBs, you maybe have one to two military working dogs who, if they sustain a combat injury in which they suffer hemorrhagic shock, then basically that dog is isolated from other dogs where, like, on a larger logistical base, you could have a military working dog walking blood bank or other dog donors that could donate blood. But in the case of a geographically isolated dog like that in this theater, that's just not a possibility. So the paper addresses an SOP that establishes a way that they basically provide blood products, specifically whole blood products for canines that are out alone and afraid at these very isolated FOBs.
Yeah, I think from myself, my prior perspective as a combat medic, I was excited initially about this paper because I was like, oh, I'm gonna have an SOP that I can basically apply to the military working dogs that I work with. And then I read the paper and I was like, there's nothing about that. It's really more aimed towards, like, the logistical complications that one might face. Is that a safe assessment?
Yes. Yeah, that's definitely a fair assessment of the paper. It's more geared towards the veterinary professionals and maybe dog handlers and or medics who are already familiar with the procedures that are involved in blood collection, and blood administration transfusions for dogs. So, as we get into some of the critiques of the paper, certainly one of the critiques is that it is lacking a bit in the detail as to how a provider might administer blood or how they might take a donation from a dog.
And there is a good resource for that. It wasn't directly mentioned in the paper, but if that's what you're looking for, listener, there is a clinical practice guideline published by the Joint Trauma System. And that is available online, very easy to see. If you just type in transfusion for the military working dog, I think it's CPG 77. It was published in December of 2019. If you're looking for that, how do I do blood typing and cross? Like, how do I handle a transfusion reaction in a military working dog? That's your resource. So don't make the mistake that I did and expect to learn more about that. There is a resource out there for you. But with that being said, I understand this paper isn't like a, what's the word I'm looking for? It's not like a clinical study where there's going to be like data streams and all that kind of stuff in it. This is more of just a, how would you describe it? It's just basically, this is kind of what our experiences are in the theater facing this problem. Is that?
Yeah, I think this paper does a good job of kind of cataloging the experiences of the providers and the system that they set up from a logistical perspective. It's really more of a logistical SOP for the military working dog blood.
All right. So, what are the three main takeaways, from your perspective and expertise in this field and the experiences you had in the Horn of Africa that this paper presents for us?
Yeah. So the three main takeaways, let me get into kind of some of the positive aspects of the paper. So some of the really great things about this SOP all kind of have to do with how simple it is. I think a lot of the great solutions in life are typically very simple, and this solution is quite simple. So it makes use of an already existing logistical system that exists in Horn of Africa. For instance, they use a CCAT team or a critical air transport team, which is a team of medical professionals, doctors, paramedics, and nurses who travel on C-130s to these various FOBs that I referenced where the military working dogs are. So basically, to transport blood is quite simple. You collect the blood, you store the blood, and then you hand it off to this CCAT team when it's time to give a blood transfusion to one of the teams out of the various FOBs. Additionally, they use an existing veterinary services OIC, so they basically make use of this position that already exists in order to oversee and run the program. Another positive about it, they seek to minimize impact on the dogs that are located at CJTF. You can imagine that a dog that has to give a blood donation like once a week, eventually that dog's probably going to get tired and it's going to have a negative effect on the dog, especially considering that a military working dog is down from work for 24 hours after it's been a donor. And so they do that by, as much as possible, they make use of dogs that are transient through that area. So as a dog is outbound or inbound into the theater, invariably they're going through CJTF, and likely that dog is going to have to give a blood transfusion as they make their way through CJTF. And then another positive about it is that they make use of human equipment. So they're not having to, if you're showing up to CJTF HOA and you are in charge of the dog blood program, you don't have to order a bunch of fancy dog blood transfusion and administration equipment. You can use stuff that's already on hand, such as human venipuncture equipment, the CPDA1 bags, which are used for human blood storage, as well as like Collins boxes and golden hour boxes that are used to maintain the cool temperature of blood to keep its storage. So those are some of the things that are really great about this paper and this SOP, is just how simple it is. And frankly, when I read the paper, having been to Horn of Africa, I was quite surprised that it was so recent that they came out with this SOP, because this seemed like really low-hanging fruit, and it only made sense that they would have filled this gap. So I thought the authors did a great job as far as that goes.
Excellent. Do you have three weaknesses or three criticisms of the paper that you thought where the paper fell short?
So one of the criticisms that I have, I think you already kind of addressed, Devin, which is that it doesn't get into the real nitty-gritty specifics of blood transfusions and blood collection from canines. So it doesn't talk about typing, like getting blood types of dogs, or even mention if there are blood types for dogs. It doesn't talk about the collection procedure, other than to say the dog is given some kind of a sedative if needed, and they're given a venue puncture. Mm-hmm. Doesn't talk about the administration or potential reactions or treatments to the reactions in the case of like an allergic reaction to a blood product. Another kind of a big issue in my opinion. So within Horn of Africa, there is a rainy season that happens every year. And during that rainy season, a lot of these fobs get completely flooded. And often what that means is that C-130 logistic runs, which this blood program relies on, are not possible.
Yeah.
Okay. And so in the event of, say, a heavy rainy season and maybe an attack by one of the local terrorist groups, there is a strong potential that a airstrip could be shut down for longer than 28 days. And in such an event, if a dog does suffer a hemorrhagic shock from combat trauma during that time, they are out of luck as far as blood products go. So I think it would have been good to see even just kind of a mention of a contingency plan for one of those eventualities. But unfortunately, we don't see any of that within the paper.
No, I appreciate that insight very much. I think our readers will too. Any other insights you have for us?
No, overall, I thought it was a great paper. I'm grateful for the authors who came up with it and grateful for the work that they're doing out there overseas.
For anybody else out there, and maybe for the authors, this would be the logistical aspects of running something like this, maybe something to add to those military working dogs, CPGs, for the next publications of those. But those resources are out there too on the Joint Trauma System website, so very easy to find. Well, Sean, I really appreciate your time today. I understand that you're going to be going to medical school, is that right?
Yeah, that's the hope. So I'll be applying to medical school this June.
Excellent. Excellent. And you're doing that as a soft to som scholar. Is that correct?
Yep, that's correct. Yeah. So I was lucky enough to be picked up for the 2024-25 cohort of soft to som scholar folks that are hopeful to go to medical school.
Yeah. Very cool. Yeah. Congratulations on that. That's no easy task. Well, thank you so much again. And looking forward to talking to you again in the future sometime.
Thanks so much, Devin. I appreciate you having me.
Well, I am hoping by the time that you are able to stitch this together, Josh, we will have an author interview for our last deep dive. And that's on emergency fresh whole blood transfusion training for Ukrainian medical professionals in austere environments. This is by a host of amazing folks, specifically Sergeant First Class Zach Brown, HM1 Josh Quinstas, HM1 Kevin Matthews, and HM1 Jonathan Schumacher, and some other folks. But nobody is as important as these all-star special operations medics that are continuing their academic education. So the abstract here, a little bit longer, but a really important topic. They say blood is a highly valuable medical resource that necessitates strict guidelines to ensure the safety and well-being of the recipient. Since the onset of the Russian terrorist attack in Ukraine, there has been an increased demand for training in emergency fresh whole blood transfusions to improve damage control resuscitation. To meet this demand, the authors developed, implemented, and evaluated a training program aimed at enhancing Ukrainian emergency fresh whole blood transfusion proficiency. They brought a total of 8 Ukrainian healthcare professionals, 6 physicians, and 2 medics to complete the training, which was derived from the Joint Trauma System Clinical Practice Guidelines, TC3 guidelines, the 75th Ranger Regiment Low O-Titer program, which we all know as ROLO, and the Marine Corps Valkyrie program, which aside has been amazing. Participants were assessed on their confidence in the practical application and administrative oversight requirements of the emergency fresh whole blood transfusion program. A cross comparison was conducted between a larger data set of third year medical students from the Uniformed Services University and the Ukrainian healthcare professionals to determine the statistical significance of the program. The difference in mean scores of the Ukrainian healthcare professionals during pre- and post-test was statistically significant. Additionally, the average rate of improvement was greater for the Ukrainian healthcare professionals compared to the third-year students. The authors conclude that in their study, they revealed the application of the Emergency Fresh Whole Blood Transfusion Training Program for Ukrainian health professionals can significantly increase confidence in their ability to conduct this life-saving intervention on the battlefield. They recommend further large-scale research is needed to determine the impact of this training on performance outcomes. Josh, which quality assessment checklist do you want to use for this paper?
Well, Alex, if you go to the Center for Evidence-Based Medicine at the University of Oxford, we will be looking at the critical appraisal of prognostic studies. Are you ready?
Yeah, I think this is the right one, but if anybody strongly disagrees with us, you're probably right, and you are welcome to send a hate email to podcast@jsomonline.org, because you're probably right, and I bet it's well-deserved.
Podcast@jsomonline, please, let us have it. Anyways, was the defined representative sample of patients assembled at a common point in the course of their disease?
Yeah, in this case, I think we could extrapolate or substitute the diseases instead the unified training platform that they provided to both the pre- and post-Ukrainian healthcare professionals, as well as the healthcare professionals compared against the third-year med students. So I would say yes.
Was the patient follow-up sufficiently long and complete?
You know, it's a good question. I don't know that I would agree with that, because I think what we care about is, are these skills still going to be viable in 6 months from now? But that's pretty hard to test. So I think they did the best job in the setting that they were in.
Were outcome criteria either objective or applied in a blind fashion?
Yeah, and you're going to see this in the manuscript. So the primary outcome was essentially the self-reported confidence at the ability to perform the procedures.
If subgroups with different prognoses were identified, did adjustment for important prognostic factors take place?
I don't think that applies to this.
I think you're right. How precise are the prognostic estimates?
Yeah, so this is a great question because it's a self-reported, and certainly as we all know from the well-regarded Dunning-Kruger effect, it's hard to appreciate if we can really rely on these results. And I do have some questions for the authors about this. Well, Josh, as always, it was late. As always, we finally got it done. And I am very much looking forward.
It didn't help that I disappeared for a month, dude. I gotta admit, yeah. Like let's call for what it is. Like, this one's mine.
It is what it is. But regardless, we are bumping right up against SOMA. Very much looking forward to seeing all of our old friends and hopefully making new ones. The work that you all do out in the field is incredibly important. And I will leave you with some wise words from Ralph Waldo Emerson, who says, "The purpose of life is not to be happy. It is to be useful, to be honorable, to be compassionate, to have it make some difference that you have lived and lived well." With that, do great things, and we look forward to seeing you soon.
This is Sophia Rodriguez, Director of Marketing and Social Media Communications for the JSOM. I want to encourage our listeners to follow us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and LinkedIn at JSOM Online, and to sign up to receive our free e-newsletter on our website at jsomonline.org. We love hearing from our subscribers and followers, and welcome your feedback and suggestions.